This episode is brought to you by Ursa Minor Outfitters. Folks, I'm absolutely in love with my Loon mug. It's handmade. It's an absolute piece of art. Whether it's at the office or at the house, people keep asking to check it out. If you're not a Loon fan, they also have other beautiful mugs for wildlife fans of moose, bears, and eagles. They specialize in products highlighting the outdoors and local pride through quality design by local artists. They've even started expanding into items beyond mugs, like apparel, dog accessories, and soon candles and more. They also try to partner and highlight other small businesses, and in some cases, forgo profits in lieu of charitable giving to help their community, such as the dog rescue. So check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for our four-legged hiking partners, they also have a portable silicone dog bowl and also a sweet over-the-collar dog bandana. Go check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and don't forget to enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. Welcome everyone to the Hikes and Mikes podcast. I'm your host Ivan, and together we'll embark on a weekly journey connecting with extraordinary hikers from all corners of the U.S. and beyond. As the cool and colorful embrace of fall envelops the Northern Hemisphere, we've had the privilege of conversing with remarkable individuals throughout this season. Their experiences and adventures will leave you yearning to hit the trails. And in today's episode, we're chatting with another amazing guest, our first from the Bay Area. His name is Chris, and you can follow him on Instagram at venturing_further. Chris not only shares with us some of his favorite places in and around the Bay Area, but also talks about what it was like growing up in Wales and enjoying the beautiful landscape it has to offer. We also hear about some truly unique experiences being out on the water, including an unexpected close encounter with orcas in the Pacific Northwest. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode with our guest, Chris. Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Hikes and Mikes podcast. I'm really excited to talk to this guest, as he's going to be the first one, I believe, from the Bay Area, and I'm excited to hear what the Bay Area has to have, because I'm hearing that that's a hidden gem for hiking experiences. But he also likes to frequent the Tahoe area, so I love Tahoe and looking forward to hearing about his experiences. Thank you, Chris, for joining us today on the podcast. Really appreciate you coming on. You know, we always like to start off by asking our guests how long they've been hiking for and how they got started.
Yeah, thanks, Ivan. Really appreciate the opportunity to come. It's a long story to start with, but we'll try and keep it down. So I've been in the outdoors most of my life. For us, it was very much a family affair. My dad was a big outdoors person. He actually started rock climbing when he was in his teens in the sort of 50s and 60s in the UK. And so we grew up as a climbing family initially, but I was born and raised in North Wales. And the one thing anybody will know about North Wales is it rains a lot, which is not conducive to a ton of rock climbing. So when it's raining, we go what we call walking or hiking. So I've been doing that pretty much all my life. My dad started us off on rock at probably about age 4. And yeah, it's just been one long journey in different ways ever since then. I was a Boy Scout for years. I did the equivalent of an Eagle Scout in the UK, which is called a Queen Scout. There's another award scheme called the Duke of Edinburgh Awards in the UK that you do. Both of those involve big multi-day hikes, carrying all your gear. So that was, you know, certainly 13, 14, all the way through to 18, and then went off to college and found all sorts of different new friends to go explore the outdoors with.
So I got to ask, how would you describe the hiking and outdoor scene growing up in North Wales?
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful, right? It's an amazing part of the world for people that don't know it for the outdoors. And what's interesting is, it's always been known for certain key aspects of it. Certainly the hiking, mountaineering, and climbing portion has always been a huge piece of the scene there. But what's amazing over this last few years is it's almost rebranding itself. So Snowdonia is a national park in the UK. So that's Northwest Wales. And they've really embraced it. So now there's all these new kind of attempts to introduce different types of outdoors activities to a whole range of people. So we were just there in the summer and they've got these amazing zip line courses for kids. There's this incredible old slate mine that's there. And what they've actually done, which is really incredible, is they've converted it into this whole activity center. And so they've put this entire bounce section underground in the mine with nets and a zip line. So, I mean, there's an amazing outdoor scene in the UK and specifically in North Wales. There's just some incredible things to go do see there. So, yeah, always been incredibly fortunate to have that connect and the ability to go back regularly and kind of experience that and enjoy that.
So that zip line is in the national park?
Yeah. So, yeah, there's several different parts to it, obviously, because, you know, it's a lot of sort of different parts of ownership throughout the area. So it doesn't exist in the same way that a national park and public lands exist in the US. So definitely this kind of mixed ownership experience. So, yeah, you've got private companies that have established different kind of centers. There's kind of big nonprofit groups. The National Trust, which is a historic preservation organization, also has a lot of land ownership and land stewardship in the area. So yeah, there's a lot of different things going on. There's one company that actually built, again, in the middle of the mountains, they built one of those artificial waves. So you can go surf in the middle of the mountain as well. It's just kind of this incredible place where all these different things are going on.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, Snowdonia. I've recently, in the last 2 years, added it to my list of destinations. And just the content that I see and the pictures and videos that people post just is remarkable. And I feel like, especially there in Snowdonia and the Lake District, like the moodiness actually adds to the beauty, where I think, like, you know, people really enjoy, like, say, Yosemite on a nice sunny day or on a nice sunny day in the winter, because it's just you see a lot more. But I feel like, at least from the videos and pictures I've seen, I kind of prefer the moodiness in the UK national parks.
Yeah. And so, the Lake District is another really favorite place of mine. As kids growing up, it's another place we used to go every year, and spend a couple of weeks, just hiking and walking through the lakes. Of those two places, they are two of the wettest places on earth, I swear. So any visit will involve rain at some point, even in the middle of summer, you'll get some kind of rain. But you're absolutely right. It completely adds to the sense of drama, and the light is always incredible because it's always kind of piercing through these clouds and you get this sort of contrast in the sky. So, I mean, it's fun as a hiker and as an outdoors person. It's super fun as a photographer as well to kind of get out there and play with that.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Now, Chris, you're based out of the Bay Area now, which is such a great launch pad for outdoor activities, because you can really go in any direction and hit either a national park, a national forest, or even the coast. Do you have some favorite local hikes in and around the Bay Area?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Bay Area is such an amazing place for the outdoors. I mean, it's a crazy place. There's so much going on. There's so many people here. The geography of it, just getting around the bay and the freeways, is always a nightmare. But within reach, wherever you are, there's always something going on. I live on the peninsula. So I live halfway between San Francisco and San Jose on the San Francisco Peninsula. And what's amazing, I think a lot of people don't realize, is around the bay you've got these great hills and then this flat bit right next to the water, and everybody lives on the flat bit, and all the hills have kind of been preserved to a larger extent, and there are these amazing kind of outdoor spaces with this really diverse set of environments that they're just incredible to kind of hang out in. And so you get everything from, you know, as you say, the coastal areas. You can kind of head up north to Marin, even the San Mateo coast, and sort of further down to Santa Cruz there's just a beautiful dramatic coastline. You get up into the hills, you get the coastal sort of oaks and that sort of, you know, brush environment. Then you get down into some of the valleys and whatever, and you've got the redwoods. And so you literally have everything. And the trick is to sort of really know where to look. There's a couple of things I like to do. So we have a number of really great state parks locally. So things like Big Basin, Castle Rock State Park, Portola Redwood State Park, sort of all up and down the peninsula. And so just some beautiful hiking and, you know, a real mix of ability and distance in there as well, which is amazing. But then we also have what's called the Peninsula Open Space Trust, or POST, and they've preserved these huge areas up and down the peninsula and into the South Bay as open space preserves. And so, you know, my absolute go-to whenever I get a chance is a place called Purisma Creek Open Space, which just sits on kind of the other side of the hill. It's 20 minutes away. I can get there in no time. You come off of, so that ridgeline that runs up and down the peninsula, there's a road that runs across the top of it called Skyline Boulevard. And so you park somewhere along Skyline, or one of just the little offshoots, and then you've got literally miles and miles of hiking. And, you know, you rarely see that many people out there just incredible. The only problem is it's always a walk down or a walk up. However you come at it, the elevation gain in there is usually, you know, anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 feet, depending on what you're doing. So, you know, it's fine. It's great for getting out in the morning, certainly getting the heart pumping, but just amazing, beautiful places kind of all around here. And I think people forget that because there's so much going on between the big cities, between the tech industry and everything else that occurs in the Bay Area. It's kind of hard to see, but it's definitely there.
Yeah. And I think it's a great mixture for those that live in the city to be able to, you know, travel not too far and find an escape in the outdoors. And one of the things that I really like from your feed is you've been able to capture the Golden Gate Bridge from some different vantage points. Are those part of that same trail system and trust?
That's actually on the other side. There's so parts around the Golden Gate Bridge are part actually national park. So when you head out onto the Marin Headlands, it's sort of a lot of that is kind of federal land. And so that's, yeah, I know the shots you're talking about, and that's from the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge up on the Marin Headlands, looking back across the bay, which is not the view you typically see. Usually people are on the other side of the bridge looking across at the Marin Headlands or looking out sort of from San Francisco out across the Golden Gate Bridge at sunset. And so, yeah, it was just a fun thing to go figure it out and hike it. So I'm an early morning hiker. And so I like to go find really interesting places at sunrise. And when you see the kind of Marin Headlands and that whole area that drops off the backside, it's an incredible place to go explore. So it was fun to just start with that kind of view of the Golden Gate Bridge and then turn around and head in the other direction. So that coastline is incredible. Anybody that's in the Bay Area, even if it's just to take a drive to go see it, is so worthwhile.
You know, I feel that water features are a regular part of your Instagram feed, and it's not just the bay, but it's lakes, rivers, waterfalls, and even the ocean. What's been your personal pull towards the water, and how did that kind of come about?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I grew up in Wales. There literally is water everywhere. It falls from the sky at any given minute. And so, you know, the outdoors has always had a backdrop of water in some way. I've lived in the US now for almost 20 years, and I've got out of the state a little bit, in all fairness. I struggle when I'm in those really dry environments. It's so different to me. It's so kind of, you know, alien in a way, because everything I grew up with and everything I was used to, there were rivers, there were lakes, there were waterfalls. And as you say, it wasn't far to the coast. You always sort of kind of had that connection to water in some way. And so for me, I just kind of naturally gravitate towards that. It's something that just feels right for me when I'm in the outdoors. I want to kind of see water. Plus, I think, you know, I'm probably a bit of an outdoors generalist. I like to do a little bit of everything. So, you know, certainly these days, hiking is the majority. I still do try and climb a little bit, try and spend a ton of time on the water in kayaks and paddle boards. So yeah, water just holds a kind of special connect for me. It's part of the complete package, right? I want to see water. I want to see mountains. I want to see beautiful landscape, trees. It's got to be the whole thing.
And you definitely have captured some amazing water features on your feed, not just from, you know, your camera, but some amazing drone shots as well.
Yeah, that's been a kind of a fun direction to head in, especially up around Tahoe, especially sort of off in the forest in some of those really remote areas, kind of going experiencing new places. What's amazing, sort of all the time up there, you kind of get to know a little bit about the history and kind of people's interaction with the landscape. And obviously, you know, it's a huge area for the gold rush. It's where the gold rush occurred. And behind that, kind of as things progressed past the typical gold rush, kind of as you think of it, the advancements towards hydraulic mining and the connection between water in the Sierra is kind of fascinating. There's all these amazing chains of lakes and all these canals that sort of intersperse these lakes and, you know, dams and waterfalls and all these kind of interesting things going on. So it's definitely been fun to kind of understand that more and kind of get out there and explore a lot more of that as well.
Yeah, you definitely make me want to go back to Tahoe on some of the things that you've been able to capture, because I just got a chance to visit it for the first time last year, and I'm itching to go back because I only scratched the surface of it.
Yeah, Tahoe is such an incredible place. I love it. I love the lake. But for everybody, I try and challenge them, and I say, you know, everybody goes and see Tahoe, and you should, right? It's a beautiful lake. There's some amazing hiking around Tahoe. But just go that little bit further afield, outside of just the immediate area on Tahoe, and there's some incredible places. If you look at that stretch sort of north and east of Tahoe, there's something like 80 lakes within really close proximity, all these sort of smaller connected alpine lakes that are kind of in the middle of nowhere. You'll see four other people at most. So yeah, it's kind of nice to get away a little bit and see some of the other sides as well. It's really incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that caught my attention that you've been able to visit and explore is the Donner Tunnels, which isn't too far from Lake Tahoe. Can you share a little bit with our listeners about the tunnels and your experience hiking through them?
Yeah. And we sort of stumbled across it. And a friend had referenced it and said, oh, you've got to go do that when you're up there. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go look at it. Thinking, you know, what is this? It's probably just, you know, 10 feet of cave and you pop out the other side. And so we went and there's this kind of random dirt parking lot and you kind of see this entrance to like a train tunnel and you're like, well, this seems a little weird. Are there still trains coming through here? I know they didn't build a lot of tunnels through the top of the Sierra. So you get there and then luckily we brought torches with us because we really weren't aware. And so you start down this path and yeah, it's over a couple of miles worth of interspersed tunnels through the top of the pass. And so, you know, I always go back and kind of read after the fact, like, oh, this was cool. I want to know more about this. And so when the famous four built the railroad going east from the West Coast, their engineer, Theodore Judah, I think his name was anyways, the engineer, this was the hardest granite they found on the whole stretch. They had this huge plan. They ran into the top of the Sierra. It was this incredibly hard granite. This is where they introduced nitroglycerin into the tunneling process. They were literally moving inches a day through these tunnels, right? And so they complete these tunnels in the late 1860s. They finally have this connect to the railroad. There's sort of tons of history around that. And then by the 1920s, they'd actually opened up another tunnel that was a longer tunnel because they had better technology. And so they kind of ran these two tunnels. And then sort of eventually as the sort of train traffic died down in, I think it was the 90s, they actually closed the Donner Summit tunnels to the trains. Mm-hmm. And so there's still a train line that runs through the other side. So people can still go back and forth through the Sierra, but they closed this section, but left it sort of as pretty much as is. They removed the rails, but you know, you're walking on broken granite on the sort of rock surface that was formerly the train bed. And it's this incredible sort of 2-3 mile hike that's fairly level, right? Because it's going through the top of the pass. And it just comes in and out through these tunnels. Each one is kind of different in its own way. Some of them are just completely hewn out of the rock. Some of them are a combination of tunnel like rock and then sort of concrete tunnels, because in addition to sort of getting through granite, they had to protect for the snow. So they're kind of the snow sheds are on top of it as well. And so you have this amazing kind of light and these tunnels. And then every once in a while, you'll pop out and you're looking down and across over Donner Lake and this amazing view kind of east into the Sierra towards kind of Reno in that way. And it just this amazing experience and really accessible. Like I say, it's an out and back. You can do as much or as little as you want. And the scenery is just stunning. You're right up there on Donner Summit.
I'm glad you mentioned it because that was going to be a question, because there are some pictures where it looked like they just basically tunneled through the rock. And then there was another picture that you posted where it had the concrete like beams, walls, it was a little bit more polished, and to have that distinction between the different tunnels is something else.
Yeah, and it really is. It's sort of a bizarre experience. And then, I mean, we were hiking it, and, you know, there's all sorts of different people do this. Again, they do sort of sections of it, or people are out for sort of full long hikes and they're connecting to other trails. And all of a sudden, we're sort of in this tunnel with headlamps on, and we just hear this noise coming from behind us. I'm like, oh my God, what is, you know, there's really not trains here, right? Everybody's like, what is that? And it was a couple of guys coming through on bikes, on motorcycles. Oh. But the noise that reverberated through those tunnels, everybody's like, oh my God, what is this? They were having a great time. Everybody got out of the way. It was all good and safe. But yeah, just a really amazing experience. If anybody's ever sort of near that area, highly recommend it.
Oh man, yeah, that would have made my heart just drop.
yeah, definitely. Because you know, like practically, you know, there's not a train coming, but you're in a train tunnel, you know, and we all watch movies or whatever. I'm like, okay, something coming.
Now, I gotta ask, Chris, is this near the infamous Donner Party area? Yeah,
that's what it's named after. So Donner Lake is about probably 15-20 minutes from Tahoe itself. So on the sort of northeast corner of Tahoe is Tahoe City. There's a road and the Truckee River comes out of Lake Tahoe through Tahoe City, and then it runs to Truckee. And Truckee sits on the bank of what's called Donner Lake. And it's named Donner Lake after the Donner Party. And that sort of the lake looks up to the pass that obviously they couldn't get through, and they were trapped up there. Which again, you know, you start to explore these places, and I love to kind of dig in on the history a little bit and kind of, you know, I knew the basics of that story, but I've, you know, read a couple of books since, and it's just fascinating, kind of understanding some of that history and some of that connection to the area.
I definitely have them high on my list next time I go to that Tahoe region, is to check out the Donner Tunnels, and you captured them beautifully. Now, Chris, this episode is going to be coming out in the middle of fall. What are some of your favorite fall hikes in and around California?
Yeah. And you really have to kind of get out the bay. The bay turns gold in kind of April, May timeframe, which is kind of this bizarre. It's because all the grasslands, right, go from green after the winter rains and then start to dry out as we head into summer. And so the hillsides all go from green to gold, you know, completely different time of year. And then, you know, obviously you get into the redwoods and whatever, and you don't get that same kind of experience of fall colors, just given the climate as well. You know, we don't get that obvious season change in the fall. So you really have to get out of the bay if you kind of want to see more of those fall colors. But, you know, for me, as you head up into the Sierra, some of the Sierra foothills kind of out towards sort of Nevada City, Grass Valley, kind of those areas when you're in the low-lying areas, you can really catch some amazing fall colors around there.
You know, with fall, that means that winter isn't too far behind. And, you know, winter doesn't slow you down, but one of the things that does happen, especially in California, is a lot of the popular destinations, including the national parks, don't get as crowded. So do you have any favorite areas that you like to explore for winter hiking?
So we've been exploring that area of Tahoe National Forest. You know, we were super fortunate to be able to, you know, fulfill a lifelong dream and actually buy a small place up there. And so, you know, we've been doing a lot of winter activities. I mean, I've always done some winter hiking. I was late to skiing. So I've never been a massive skier, but I enjoy it. Certainly sort of winter mountaineering, but I wasn't ready for this winter, this past winter. so I'll tell you that for nothing. Yeah. And so, you know, I got snowshoes. So last couple of years, I've been kind of exploring with snowshoes, kind of off in the forests. This last early winter, we did this amazing hike with the kids. There's an area north of Tahoe near Incline Village, is one of the big ski resorts, and it's called Chickadee Ridge. And again, it's fairly easygoing. Snowshoes are definitely warranted. Otherwise, you start post-hauling in deep snow. But the whole area is inhabited by these little chickadees that are so used to the humans that if you happen to have, and have read the internet in advance, bird seed with you, they'll come and eat out of your hand, which is just this kind of surreal and cool experience. So you kind of snowshoe into this area, you get away from everybody else, and then you kind of stand there like a scarecrow with your arms out wide. And then all of a sudden, these little chickadees come in and just kind of land on you and start eating, which was just super fun, completely different experience, not what we were expecting, but we had a great time doing that. But yeah, so just kind of getting out and exploring some of those places has been super great. I will say just, yeah, this past winter was something else, you know, and we have areas that we typically go to. We know folks up there, folks that were plowing certain roads that, you know, we're aware of. And it'd be great. So you pull in, you find a little pull-in space where they've plowed the road. Then you start to climb 10 feet to get on top of the snow to go anywhere. and it was something else. It really was. I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah. I think you guys are still getting some snow melt this late in the season.
Yeah, it's incredible. And what's amazing is the temperature is now starting to turn in the other direction. So who knows what happens this year?
Yeah.
You know, there's a different dynamic. We'll see. But oh my goodness. Yeah. That snow.
Yeah, if you guys can send some up. We didn't have a bad winter, but we didn't have anything near what California and Utah and Nevada got. But we would take, you know, a couple hundred inches, no problem.
Yeah, sure. I'll just ship those up for you.
Now, Chris, one place that does come up on your feed a lot too, and it's a place that I'm fascinated with. I'm hoping to visit it in 2024, and that's Pinnacles National Park, which, because California has just some incredible national parks in such a close vicinity, I feel like Pinnacles and Kings Canyon don't get the crowds or the recognition that the other ones do. But you've really showed some unique places in and around Pinnacles. What's been your experience visiting the national park, and maybe some trail recommendations?
So Pinnacles is a great place. It's definitely the little park that could. It's such a unique environment. It's kind of very different to what else you see in other sort of big national parks throughout the state. And it's got this kind of, you know, these amazing rock formations that are just so much fun to kind of go explore and get lost in. So for me, the first time I went was a friend. Somebody had recommended it. Everybody had said, oh, you got to go to Pinnacles. I'd never been. Like, oh, well, we'll go down on a Friday night. We'll camp. get up early, we'll go there, you know, go out and hike the next day. Because the other thing that everybody says about Pinnacles is just don't go in the summer because it gets really hot, right? It's really sort of, and there's not much shade. So we actually went in February completely by chance. It was clear, but it was cold. We camped overnight and then we're getting up in the morning and this guy in the next campsite is like, oh, you're doing the caves, right? I'm like, what do you mean the caves? It's like, oh, you've got to go do the caves. Like the caves are never open. And there's this cave system through Pinnacles. It's called Bear Gulch Caves. And there's nesting bats in portions of the cave. And so for most of the year, they're inaccessible. The lower caves are often open, start and the end of the year. The upper caves are rarely open. And this guy says, the whole cave system's open. You've got to go do the caves. I'm like, okay. Wow. So, you know, you expect this kind of little kind of hike through a cave and it's not. It's this incredible sort of climb up this sort of gulch through this kind of network. And, you know, it's not caves as in holes in the rock. It's caves that have been formed by collapsing boulders and kind of this, you know, intricate network that you're sort of, the path leads you up through. And, you know, again, luckily we had head torches. And so you follow this system of paths up through these caves and it's very dark. There's a creek or a stream running all the way down it. This is February, so it's post rains. You know, we were lucky it's clear, but that creek was running. And so we get into the upper section of the caves. It, you know, pretty well developed path at the bottom kind of evaporates on your way up. And I just remember looking back at my friend. I'm like, are you sure this is right? As we're sort of on hands and knees in 8 inches of water, kind of looking at a waterfall, like, I'm pretty sure we go that way. And we sort of edged around this corner and then somebody had painted this white arrow on the wall. I'm like, oh yeah, no, this is definitely and then you sort of pop out at the top of this system through this gulch and there's this sort of lake at the top. And it's just, I mean, this amazing kind of magical place that I think most people, you know, don't know about, don't get to experience. But it's totally worth it. And then from there, you go up onto the high peaks, which is, you know, throughout all these rock formations, there's areas where, you know, steps have been carved into the rock and these sort of platforms have been built. And it's just an amazing place. So I've been back several times. I love it up there. And actually about almost exactly a year ago, because it was on October 10th. I love October 10th. It's 10-10. So it's just kind of a fun thing. So we did a 10-10 hike and we got up. So Pinnacles is about 2 hours from the Bay Area, depending on where you are. So we got up very, very early. So we were there and we were in the first parking space right by the trail. We were the first people there. We probably got there about 5:30. It was about kind of an hour and a half hike up to where we knew we wanted to be, which is kind of up on the way to the high peaks. And we sat there kind of eating a breakfast of granola bars and drinking water. We hadn't planned that bit very well. And on the west side, we had this full moon dropping over the valley, which was completely sort of misted over. And on the east side, you had the sun rising on the other side, again, over this valley, completely misted over. And it was just the most surreal, incredible experience. And just like such an amazing place to just sit and watch the world kind of come to life. And then we went up often through the high peaks. And then the kind of favorite part of that day is you're coming down and you know, we were done and we'd done, I think, 8-9 miles, and it was still only like 9 o'clock in the morning. And you've got these people kind of marching up the trail and they're excited because they're like, this is it, I'm first on trail. And you come down like, yeah, we're done. And that sort of look of desperation, like, oh man. But yeah, we had a great time. It was fun. But yeah, I love Pinnacles. I think, again, people who visit California, visit Central California, there's all those must-dos that you have to go see. Mm. And so for a lot of people, you know, Pinnacles isn't close to that list. I know it can be a bit of a lightning rod for some people. You know, some people love it, some people don't. But certainly if you live in the area, if you're in the area for an extended period, if you're in the area in Central California when you know it's peak season, because we've all been in national parks in peak season these days and it's all almost impossible. It's just this incredible other alternate place where it's totally worth a look.
What incredible experiences. I gotta ask, Chris, now that you've been back a couple times, has the cave system been fully open since that first time?
I've not been through the full system since that first time. The majority of those caves are open, but then you hit a point and there's a big metal gate and it's closed because of the nesting bats. And so, yeah, there's a website. The National Park website is really good. They sort of keep it updated, and it literally is quite often just a 2-week window, and you've just got to kind of catch it at that right moment. moment. And I think it's either October or February are the only times. And even then, it's not always the full system that's open. You know, and again, not the longest hike in the world, but like one of those completely unforgettable, like amazing places to go hang out.
Yeah. You know, outside of California, you've also been able to travel to other states and other countries. You know, we talked about visiting Wales and Ireland earlier this year, but one place that has definitely blown up in popularity over the last couple of years because of social media and YouTube is Playa del Amor, which is about an hour boat ride from Puerto Vallarta, and it's in Las Islas Marietas National Park. And it's one of those unique places where in order to get to this hidden beach, there's no boat traffic. Like you get dropped off outside of the island and then you got to swim in. Can you share a little bit about that experience?
Yeah. And this was just sort of one of those stars aligned for us. We've been going down to that area for a long time, sort of almost as long as I've been in California. We love it down there. The people are amazing. It's an amazing part of the world. But we'd never made it out to the Marietas, and we'd known about it. People had talked about it. You know, we'd done other boat trips around the Bay of Banderas. And so my wife and I were there without the kids for a change, which we love them, but this was not the trip to take them on. So we were talking to a person we know down there that's helped us facilitate adventures in the past. And he's like, oh no, yeah, I know this guy. There's always, somebody always knows a guy with a boat. And so they take you out there. It's an hour on the boat, you know, and the nicest people. But it's definitely one of those kind of Instagram versus reality moments. So firstly, you get a permit. You have to have a permit to go. The park rangers are sitting on a boat offshore on the island. So they sit out there and they're checking every boat that comes in proximity, and they're checking everybody for their permit, and it's a wristband. And so they're counting people in and out. And then, you know, it has to be timed right with the tides and whatever. And then they kick you off the boat, and that's it. You're swimming in to this tunnel, right? And then you come out on this amazing beach in the middle. But it's all timed. The permits are all timed. So you only get about 10, 15 minutes on the beach.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, okay, everybody jump in, swim like hell to get, you know, through these waves. The guy who's leading us is in a full wetsuit with flippers and everything. He's like, I'm going to go first because there's tons of jellyfish in this area. So I'm going to go push them out the way. So that's the first thing you're contending with. It's like, oh, wait, there's jellyfish? Okay, this will be fine. It'll all be good. This guy tells me it's fine. So you kind of try to follow as closely as you can without getting hit by flippers. You go through this tunnel. And again, I don't want to take away from the experience. It is an incredible experience. I loved every second of it. But these sort of visions of this beautiful golden beach that you have all to yourself and, you know, hours on end, that doesn't happen. You kind of swim in. And then we had an amazing guide. He was like, I'm going to show you all these things that I know here. So you could sit on this beach and take pictures of yourself for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. but we're going to make the most of this time. And so he would rush us off and he's like, okay, now this way, now get down on your belly and we're going to crawl under this rock and we're going to pop out in this other secret cove over here. And so it was just this kind of really fun, incredible experience. It was one of the amazing places that you go and you visit and you're just like, wow, you know, I don't get to come places like this very often. So I'm going to appreciate every second of it. And then it's over and it's like, okay, and now we have to swim back to the boat. It's like, wait, I want to do this again. How do I do this again? And so, you know, and then they took us out and we, you know, we saw, it was incredible. You know, it's an incredibly biodiverse area. This is why it's a national marine park. So we saw dolphins, we saw whales, we saw a lot of, you know, marine animals. We had fun outside of that as well. Yeah. But yeah, it was just this kind of bizarre, but amazing experience. But definitely not sort of laying on a golden sand beach, taking selfies of yourself for hours on end. It was like, you're in, you're out. There's other people there.
Oh, that's so good to know. Cause yeah, I didn't even think that there was going to be like a time permit, but 10, 15 minutes. Yeah. You got to make the most out of it.
Yeah. The guy who took us was incredibly knowledgeable about the sort of the conditions of the natural habitat as well. And, you know, I think what the locals really appreciate is while they know that everybody wants to be there and kind of everybody wants to experience that, is that it's done that way to preserve the natural environment. And it's actually doing a really good job of doing that, right? It's really limiting that exposure. And I think, you know, it's kind of always one of those difficult things that, you know, we see these places, we always want to go and experience, but having that kind of conscious thought around what is the impact of me visiting and me and the other 1,000 people that are here today, you know, it kind of brings that home in a really important way as well.
I got to ask, Chris, because, you know, you mentioned that our national parks are getting busy, and a lot of them are switching to these timed permits. And some of the more popular ones, you got to plan, not well in advance, but you got to plan in advance in order to secure a permit for a day. What's the permit process there to get to La Playa?
So, I mean, we were really fortunate. It was all facilitated for us by the person running the tour. And I think for the most part, I think that's the case, is that they, you know, before they'll even fill it, because they're trying to fill a boat with a set amount of people, however many they have. So they coordinate that. I mean, it had to be booked in advance. I think we booked like 4 or 5 days in advance. We weren't there in high season. So it wasn't sort of massively busy. So I think, again, we were super fortunate. But yeah, you've got to sort of, you know, I know people visit areas like that. They have a limited amount of time. If it's something that you're going to do, it's like talk to somebody early on, you know, figure out that path. And yeah, luckily we were with a group that took care of all of that for us.
And, you know, we talked about it a little bit before, but you were able to make it back out to Wales and you got to visit Ireland. How was that experience? And, you know, I got to ask, because you had another incredible water experience by paddling in Wales in a unique setting. So I'm hoping you could share a little bit about that experience as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, going home to Wales is always an amazing thing, you know, and so my mom still lives in the house that I grew up in, right? So it's literally going home for me, and, you know, still friends I see in the area and we hang out. But then it's also the opportunity to kind of do some of those fun things and kind of catch on to some of those adventures. So in addition to kind of, you know, playing underground in Snowdonia, I got a couple of opportunities to go out and hike early morning, which is just, again, that's my thing. And again, so what's interesting, you know, you talk about national parks and being busy. Snowdonia kind of suffers from that same issue. And there, the parking lots are probably, you know, 15, 20 cars at most. So, you know, the very popular spaces is like, oh, you've got to be there early. Otherwise, you're never going to get parked, or you're in a lay-by somewhere, you know, 2 miles from the start. So I was kind of one of the first cars in the parking lot, got out and, you know, had this amazing experience up in some areas that, you know, hold a lot of personal meaning for me. So, you know, it was just a really great experience. But then the other sort of big Wales adventure for us is a friend had talked about this thing that was on their bucket list. He said, hey, you're going to be there. I'm going to come see you. We want to go do this thing. Like, let's all do it together. I was like, okay. And like I said, you know, we're outdoor generalists. So we do a little bit of everything. We do like to paddle. We've done several kind of paddle trips. And this was one of those on water experiences to paddle on. So throughout the UK, there's the network of canals that were built for narrow boats during the Industrial Revolution to move goods, essentially. And in Wales, there's a pretty famous bridge that's an aqueduct. So the narrowboat canal goes over a river, and it's about 130 feet high. It's about 12 feet wide, and there's this sort of canal and then a towpath. And, you know, you've been able to sort of certain times been able to walk on the towpath side. There's a railing, right? And so you could walk along that. But it's not until fairly recently that they've allowed people to actually paddle across the bridge. And so we did a canoe trip across it's called the Pont Cysylltwyth Aqueduct, and it's actually a World Heritage Site. And, you know, the bridge itself is only about 300 feet long, but it's this incredible experience where you're sat in a canoe and you're sort of just looking over the edge of this canal. And then there's this 130-foot drop to a river that's sort of running in the other direction underneath you. So kind of bizarre and unique. And you have to, so boats still use it. So narrow boats in the UK on the canals are still a really popular, like vacation kind of activity. People go and rent a boat for a weekend or a week and they travel down the canals. So you're there in a canoe and you're kind of having to sort of figure out, okay, are there any boats coming across the bridge? Like, how do we get on? Sort of timing it right. But yeah, another one of those kind of really unique, interesting experiences that we got to do, and totally worth it. A really good, fun thing.
Did you have to rent the canoes to do that experience?
So again, with that one, we went with a guided tour. You know, we're not above it. So we have our own kayak here in the US. We do a lot of sort of kayak trips ourselves. But when traveling, stuff like that, sometimes it's just easier to kind of go with a guided tour. And with that one, it was kind of all in. They kind of knew the situation. There was a guide in one of the boats with us. He's like, okay, you know, this is how we're going to approach this. This is what we're going to do, which just made it a really great experience. I know, you know, some people do it by themselves and that's great too. There's definitely opportunities to rent boats and stuff. But yeah, for us, that just made a lot of sense. It was good fun.
That's good to know. Yeah, that there's guided services that you could participate in and be able to experience that. Now, Chris, one of our common segments, and this kind of follows up with your paddling experiences, we like to do a deep dive on our guests' Instagram feed and pick out a picture that captures our attention. And, you know, me being from the Pacific Northwest, it definitely caught my attention that you got to paddle in the San Juan Islands and see some beautiful orcas in their natural habitat. But then I'm almost positive, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you also got to camp at our state's smallest state park, which is the Little Island. How was that experience paddling in and around the San Juans and then camping on that small state park?
So again, sort of another one of those incredible experiences with friends. And again, sort of straight off the bat, that was a guided tour as well. It was a 2 full-day paddle with camping. So we had all the gear with us. We were in double kayaks. This was back, it was pre-pandemic. It was almost 5 years ago. That was another October 10th experience. So 10 out of 10 experiences are always on, they're always highlights for us. So, you know, I had actually been out in Seattle on a business trip. And so, you know, we all sort of met up in Seattle. We actually got to take a float plane out to Friday Harbor on San Juan, which was great. We stayed in Friday Harbor for a night and hung out there. And then it was sort of like an ecotourism group that does, you know, guided tours really focused on the natural environment in this sort of this kayak excursion. And it was a really small group. So it was my wife and I plus two of our closest friends, and then there was three other people on the trip and a guide, so four boats total. And yeah, it was this surreal experience. So we'd spent the first full day paddling out from San Juan around kind of Henry Island, you know, into the Harrow Strait, heading up towards Posey Island, which is where the campsite was. And before you kind of make that turn around and in, we'd seen, you know, bald eagles, we'd seen harbor seals, I think we'd seen some dolphins, we'd seen tons of stuff, but we'd seen no orcas. And so when you're out in the strait, before you kind of make that turn into Posey Island, there's, I think it's called Battleship Island. There's this big rock that's out, kind of out there. And our guide is looking around and he says, okay, let's just pull up. And we rafted. So we put all four boats together and kind of held on. And he positioned us with kind of this island behind us, because what he'd seen was the tour boats were out and the tour boats were coming up the strait towards us. And what that meant was they probably were following orcas, right? And that there were whales in the environment. He's like, well, if we see here, they're probably going to come past us at a distance. It's a great opportunity for us to see orcas. Like, okay, that's really cool. And you could see it, right? I mean, we're probably, you know, a ways off, you know, in the distance, but you could kind of see a couple of breaches. You could kind of see it. Couple of tails coming up, but these boats are kind of peeling off towards the strait and going right. And as we're sitting there, the guide's like, oh, hold on a sec, like, nobody move, hold on to each other's boats, like, honestly, just don't move, just stay still. I'm like, okay, why? And he just points over to the left, and while the main pod was coming up the strait, a mother and her calf were away from the pod and away from the boats and had come up to the left side of us, and we're gonna come past us on the left. And we're like, oh wow, this is really kind of insane but really cool. And you feel incredibly exposed when there's a really large sea mammal like not that far away from you and you're in a kayak. But anyway, so we sort of look over, and I think the video is edited, the one that's posted, because there were some choice swear words going at the time, because all of a sudden this mother and her calf just turn right at us, right? And all of a sudden they come up and they're so incredibly graceful, right? And I just remember seeing them just come up above the water and then just slip right down underneath us. And so I had a GoPro in hand, and so I'm just like pointing this GoPro, and then another person that was on the trip like had the foresight to just throw their hand under the water with their GoPro. And so kind of these two videos together show these orcas just literally swim right up to us and then just dive straight underneath us. And even that in itself was this incredible moment. But my goodness, you're just like, oh, wow, they're displacing how much water? Like, how are we not going to trip in this situation? But I mean, they didn't. You don't even feel it. It's like this little ripple sort of just bumps you over in the boat. And you're like, oh, wow. But just like everybody kind of looked at each other afterwards, like, did that really happen? And even the guide was like, yeah, this isn't normal. Like, don't think we tricked you into this. And like, we bring everybody out saying, oh, you might see some whales. And yeah, then we have them swim under your boat. This isn't typical. And it was, yeah, amazing. And then, so that was definitely a highlight. And then after that, we paddle on and then we find Posey Island, which is I do believe it's the state's smallest park. It's about an acre, yeah, right? The island. And there's a couple of different campsites there. I believe it's reserved exclusively for paddle in. Right? It's only people with, you can't go there on a boat. You've got to paddle in. Human powered vehicles are the only way to kind of get there and camp there. And of course, we had to carry everything with us. So, you know, pulling out the tents and the sleeping bags out the kayaks, spent the night there, which was incredible. Like, again, it's only four tents. And so all the tents were on different parts of this 1 acre island. So got to wake up in that amazing environment and just, you know, there was nobody around, just incredibly peaceful, incredibly beautiful location. And then had to paddle a full day to get out as well, which, you know, by the end of that second day, it's just like, oh yeah, I'm feeling this now.
I imagine it's like backpacking, you know, when you're having to head out on that final day. I can only imagine the oars must feel a little bit heavier on that last day that you got to paddle out, right?
Yeah, we've had some fun experiences with kayak camping. And one in particular where, you know, we had two families, I think three or four kids with us. It was, you know, a lot. It was a 4 mile paddle in and out with kids and all our gear and all our water and everything else. And I remember that last day sort of thinking, oh man, this is going to be rough, trying to get out. And in fact, me and a friend paddled out, tried to hire a boat so we could go and get all the stuff and everybody else out. Failed, so I had to paddle back in and then paddle back out again. So days like that are tough on the water, but definitely worth it. But yeah, I mean, definitely akin to those long hikes, right? Those multi-day hikes when you get that sort of that last day and you know how far you've got to go and, you know, feet ache, shoulders ache. You know, you're trying to lose as much food and water as you've got left. Like, I can make it through the day on just this stuff. Yeah, very, very much like that. But again, that same kind of, you know, experience of just amazing achievement and kind of, you know, amazing experience and seeing these wild places that, you know, a lot of people don't even get close to is just, yeah, an incredible thing.
Yeah. What an incredible experience. I mean, you see orcas in videos, but I feel like, especially how close they got to you. And I think one of the comments was like, I would have crapped my pants or something.
Yeah. There was definitely something like that.
Yeah, what an epic experience. And I'm glad you were able to experience that, because I feel like whale season in the San Juans, it's probably less than 50-50. But like, I feel like the people that do the boat tours, either they see them or they don't see them. And if they do see them, it's, you know, from a distance. So the fact that you got an up close encounter that.
Yeah, I wouldn't change it for the world. If you'd have told me on the way in that an orca was going to come and swim into my boat, I'd have been a bit like, I don't know about that. But I wouldn't change it for the world. It was incredible.
Now, Chris, you know, I'm interested in seeing if you have any regular routines that you do on your hikes or maybe even on your paddle experiences. But I feel like a lot of day hikers, especially, they have some regular routines that they do. Maybe it's packing their favorite snack or meal, maybe some trail beverages or having coffee or tea in the morning, or even just a moment of zen. Do you have a regular custom that you do when you make it to your destination or maybe when you make it back out?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. So, and I think it changes over time, right? And it changes who you're with and kind of where you've been and what you're doing. So I'm definitely an early morning person. I love those kind of before dawn hikes, like getting on trail with a head torch and then experiencing kind of sunrise out there. That's definitely a moment of zen for me. And I absolutely love that. Depending on, you know, whether I'm friends or, you know, family members, getting that experience and then stopping for breakfast on the way home is a special treat, right? Especially when you know you've achieved it. You know, we always talk about type 2 fun. And what I love about type 2 fun is the reflection at the end. So yeah, I think for me, if it's definitely one of those shared experiences, I like that piece. A lot of what I do, like I said, early morning, I often do on my own. So that's kind of more those individual moments of zen. I've got slower more recently. And I think Instagram's to blame for some of that, because I do stop and take a lot of pictures and a lot of content. For me, that's part of the experience. It was definitely, you know, go back 5-10 years, I was one of those people that would march it, right? I'm like, man, I've got 15-20 miles to do today. I'm going to knock it out and be done. Now I'm quite happy doing a lot less, you know, and just taking my time and stopping along the way and really experiencing those different moments in different places. So that's a big thing for me.
You know, one thing that you've gotten into, and I've dabbled in, I have a drone, but I'm still very cautious in how I fly it or where I fly it. And you've been able to capture some amazing moments in and around water. What's been your experience flying a drone? And then do you have any tips or advice on flying over water? water.
So I bought my drone. It was Christmas last year, and I love it. And it's so much fun. You know, the one thing, so right out the gate, if you're going to buy a drone, do your research in advance. So I definitely bought what seemed like a really good access point, and I love it. I enjoy it. There's a couple of key features that I don't have on the drone I have right now that I wish I had and make all the difference. So definitely do your research up front. The thing that people, you know, I often see these Instagram posts, and the thing that people don't tell you about drones is everybody says you should get one, but there's real limits on where you can fly them, and kind of understanding that is really important. So I'm really lucky. I get up into the mountains a lot. I get up into the national forest a lot, and you can fly a drone up there. There's pretty much like one or two postage stamp sized areas in the Bay Area that you can fly a drone.
Oh, wow.
Just between all the sort of the airports, the small airports, you can't fly over national parks. You can't fly over national seafront. So, I mean, I do not fly my drone in the Bay Area. Just the limits are fairly significant. The opportunities are really limited. But once I get away from that, I love it. I really enjoy it. I have a lot of fun with it. I do, you know, there's a couple of areas of seafront. So getting out over the ocean was some of my early experiences, and it is incredibly nerve-wracking. I was out on the beach on the San Mateo coast recently, and I could see a fishing trawler sitting, you know, about a half mile offshore, kind of traversing level with the coast. I'm like, man, that would be a really cool drone shot. And I went for it and I did it. But it was just panic the whole time. Like, oh my God, it's going in the sea. It's going in the sea. I'm never going to see it again. And it, you know, it worked out. I had some really sort of interesting footage that I kind of really like. It was one of those misty days and super fun, but definitely nerve-wracking. I've also had some kind of fun experiences in the mountains where, you know, and they have an incredible range, but all of a sudden you realize you're behind a ridgeline or behind a tree, and that range will drop off very, very quickly. And so just kind of keeping an eye on how far it is, where it is, how you get it back, is often the key. I've had some really close calls. I actually did clip a tree fairly recently. It went down in forest, in heavy forest. It took me about, I think it was about 45 minutes of bushwhacking to actually locate my drone. And, you know, there's a function where you press a button and the lights flash and it makes a noise. I'm like, I know it's around here somewhere. I'm in like deep undergrowth trying to plow my way through all this stuff, trying to find it. But I did. So, you know, I think you have to have that attitude that, you know, at some point you may crash and you may lose it. And that's part of the experience, I think.
Yeah, I think this year I haven't flown it recreationally a lot, but the few times that I have flown it is to kind of help me scout out hikes where either the trail's not as defined, or most recently I was looking for our Western larches to see if they were turning. And rather than climb the 3,000 feet of elevation gain to see if they're there, I just send up the drone and I'm like, okay, they're still not turning. Give it 2-3 more weeks and then I'll do the same thing. Send it up, make sure that they're turning, and then do the actual hike.
So the one thing I will say is, you know, I'm super conscious with it as well. And I know a lot of people are. I mean, I've sat under drones as they fly by. I mean, they do feel like a kind of a slightly weird intrusion at times. And so I'm always super conscious. Try not to fly near people, near wildlife. I'm generally in areas where there's nobody around, because, you know, I'm definitely very conscious of the impact that it has on other people's experience when there's this kind of really annoying thing buzzing overhead. And I'm sort of happily sat half a mile away like, oh, this is amazing. there's definitely that aspect as well.
Now, Chris, we're almost at the end of 2023. Do you have any remaining hiking goals for the rest of the year, or maybe some upcoming hiking goals for 2024?
It's especially this last probably year and a half. For me, it's just, you know, every weekend, you know, how do I get out in some way every weekend is generally my goal, and sort of very much kind of being in the outdoors, sort of having those experiences, being out sort of hiking is that sort of moment of zen, that ability to kind of process everything else that's going on in a busy life. And so that's always my number one goal, is to spend as much time outside as possible. I do have some sort of specific hike goals. There's some areas I want to go explore. I've never been a massive through hiker, but now kind of being exploring areas up near the PCT, I just keep getting intrigued by doing sort of sections of that, different sort of, you know, being one of those occasional hikers that do portions and trying to accumulate over time. I definitely want to do a little bit more winter work. Yeah, snowshoeing has been an experience. I like it. It took me a minute, but, you know, everybody talks about Lassen National Park as like the place to snowshoe. Really? And that's kind of high on my list to go and experience that and get up towards sort of Mount Shasta and some of those things in winter. That's definitely up there.
Nice. Yeah, I just got into snowshoeing for the first time last year, and it was at my local ski resort. And for the longest time, I didn't know that your lift ticket gave you access to the snowshoe trail.
Yeah.
And we did a twilight one, and that was the perfect way to get introduced into snowshoeing, just because it was perfect weather. And I know it's not going to be perfect all the time, but just a nice introduction. And, you know, the very next day I went to Costco and bought my snowshoes.
Yep. That's how it goes. It's a gateway, right? But yeah, and I think for me, it just had this kind of, I didn't get it. I didn't fully understand it until I'd done it. And then I'd done it. I'm like, oh, well, this is great. This is just like gives me opportunity to hike more just when it's snowing, which is sort of, you know, kind of weird. I don't know why it took me a while to kind of get into that mind space, but I'm really glad I did. I really enjoy it. Yeah, it's fun.
Same here. Now, Chris, that was it for the regular questions. This last portion of the podcast is the this or that questions. I'm going to be giving you two hiking related topics, and you just choose which one you personally like between the two. So
okay.
The first one is, do you prefer ascending or descending?
I'm getting older, so descending. Although the knees definitely feel it, but got to go up to go down, though, right? And definitely appreciate that moment of kind of as you hit summit. You know, there's nothing like that. So I'd probably say descending because it's easier. But I love the way up too. That's a tough one, but yeah.
This one's equally as tough. But waterfalls or summits?
Waterfalls on the way to summits. Ooh, why would you do anything
else? I like that answer. Now this one's another trail question, but switchbacks or straight up?
So definitely switchbacks. I've done too many hikes that have just been like long haul straight up, like, you know, death hikes. Some that have been sort of literally carved into the side of mountains as steps. And I remember one of those like long multi-day experiences, you know, being young and not planning my route well and just started a day with full pack and water going up, you know, a couple of thousand feet on mainly just steps. I much prefer a nice gentle switchback. The opportunity to catch that view as you kind of cut back is always perfect as well, right?
And this next one is, do you prefer trek poles or freehand?
So definitely freehand. Trek poles have become more of a thing with the snowshoeing, and I totally get it in that environment because the amount of times you catch a snowshoe and that's it, you're heading forwards face first. But if I'm just out kind of hiking and walking, then I tend to be freehand, although camera in hand a fair bit.
Okay. And there's been a big shift in the last, like, I would say 5 to 10 years on footwear. So do you prefer trail runners or hiking boots?
So I'm a bit of a gear nerd, so I have everything. And yet I probably prefer neither. So as a climber, I wear an approach shoe more than anything else.
Yeah.
So, right, which kind of sit halfway in between the two. So you've got the grip and the structure of a boot, but the sort of, you know, kind of low ankle ease of a, and a little bit more flexibility of a trail runner. So yeah, approach shoe is my go-to. Okay.
And this next one is another trail system question, but a loop trail or an out and back trail?
Yeah. And so this might be controversial, but I think I'm probably more of an out and back. And I will tell you that Pinnacles hike, that was a loop trail that I did as an out and back because the front half is amazing and the back half just is a bit, you know, whatever. So I've been known to get halfway around on the good side and be like, I like that. I'll do it again. So yeah, I'm good with an out and back.
Now, when it comes to bodies of water that you come across, do you jump in or do you stay dry?
I try and jump in. I can be a little bit of a wimp at times, especially when it's snow melt and it's really, really cold, but always at least get a foot in and experience the water live. There's no point just kind of watching it flow by.
And this one's tough because I think you enjoy both of them, but sunsets or sunrises?
Yeah, it is tough, right? And so an amazing experience. It was actually, funnily enough, it was the same friend that got us to canoe across the aqueduct, was out visiting us in California last year, and said, oh, I really need to catch these California sunsets and sunrises. I'm like, you know, been here almost 20 years. You see them all the time. It's like every day. What's the big deal? And she said, you're kidding, right? Like, you have some of the best sunrises and sunsets in the world. Why are you not out there every single day? And ever since, I do try and kind of catch at least one of them, because it is, right? It's this amazing kind of moment in the day. I do like to think of myself as a little bit of a photographer, and the light is incredible, like at that time. So I'm always out there kind of looking for that. But if I had to pick between the two, it's probably sunrises. I am a morning person. I love to kind of that experience of getting out before the world when it's still dark and then just kind of seeing it come to life. There's something amazing about that. I love that.
And this one's another tough one, because especially this year, you guys had the super blooms, but spring wildflowers or fall colors?
Yeah, I probably would have said fall colors, but you're absolutely right. This year has been incredible for the super bloom. Just some really amazing hikes out there that have just been filled with incredible flowers. And so, yeah, I still think fall colors. And part of that is because I grew up in a colder climate. I miss traditional seasons. In the Bay Area, you know, we get summer and then we get a couple of months of rain and then we're back into it. We don't get fall in the traditional sense. And I miss that. I kind of love that transition between summer and winter. So yeah, probably fall colors a little bit.
And the last one is the most controversial one, but when it comes to social media, do you tag a hike or do you not tag a hike?
Yeah. So I don't tend to tag the specifics. And occasionally I will if it's incredibly well known, you know, if people just look at that and like, I know where that is. But, it, you know, I'm a great believer in, you know, the experiences that we share in the outdoors are some of the best experiences that we have. And so giving people access to that and the ability to experience it as well, I think is a good thing. However, I've been on the other end of it and, you know, areas that I thought were great and secluded and hidden suddenly become popular and it's like, oh, now I can't go there anymore. So, you know, for me, I think, and, you know, it's not hard to figure out where these places are, right? If you just do a little bit of work. So I'll generally tag an area and, you know, maybe something that's, you know, a bit of a signpost and then let people figure it out. So, you know, a lot of my stuff in the Sierra, I'll tag Tahoe National Forest, which is a massive area. And maybe I'll say, oh, out on the Yuba River. And again, there's incredible places all along the Yuba River. So you go find where you want to experience it. Maybe you'll find the same place I did. Maybe you won't, but you'll find somewhere great that kind of looks like this. You know, so give people the opportunity to experience it, but I don't have to kind of give them the exact geolocation of where I'm going to be. I think that's probably my philosophy.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what a lot of people are going towards is general locations, unless it's a well-known area. And I kind of like that you leave breadcrumbs, so if people really want to find out, they can find out. And that's a good approach, because especially with all the tools we have accessible, you can find places pretty easily if you just put in the effort.
Yeah, I totally agree, right? And what's interesting is I always think of some of the most interesting places I've been or found is because I've been looking for something else, right? I've said, oh, wow, somebody went somewhere, yeah, I'm going to go look at that and figure it out. I'm like, oh, but there's this really cool place on the way. I'm going to go see that instead. And so, yeah, give people the opportunity to find places and find their own adventures and take it from that.
Now, for folks that haven't had a chance to follow you on Instagram yet, what are some of the, or what's your handle? And is there any other places they can see your photography or your drone footage?
So my handle is Venturing Further with, it's got two underscores. I used to just go by my name all the time for the longest time. And then somebody's like, oh, you should change it. So I did fairly recently. And that's really kind of it. It's kind of been this interesting experience. Like I said, I've always been into photography and in some ways sort of Instagram has been this kind of new journey into video, short form video a little bit more, which has been great and exciting and fun. I've always kind of just done it for me. It's kind of my release, my escape. In fact, sort of about a year and a half ago, what it really was it was another good excuse to get outside, you know, and it became this sort of motivating factor. And I love that about it. And I kind of really enjoy the opportunity to put it out there and share it. So that's kind of it. You know, I'm always looking for opportunities to share. I post stuff, you know, random photos and things that I'm taking through my stories. My main form is I post a ton of reels, just a, you know, short form video that I find just because I find it just fun to kind of put those together. But yeah, no, it's definitely been an experience, a bit of an adventure. I ran into this amazing quote recently, this audio, and it was on Instagram. And it was really funny because, you know, it's become this kind of creative outlet, which I don't think I had for a while, and which has been really good. But it said, and I'll probably butcher this and somebody will correct me if need be, but it said, imagine you were in an artist studio or whatever, and you were putting out whatever it is you create. And, you know, 100 people walk by, and of those 100 people, 10 people stop to say, hey, I really like that. That would be incredibly rewarding. And we'd feel great about that. And yet sometimes on Instagram, we forget that, right? And it's like, oh, I need like 1,000 views and I need 100 likes. And sometimes it's just like, you know what? 10 people stop by and they kind of dug what I put out there. And I like that aspect. So, you know, I'm not pushing to create massive followings or anything like that. I'm just, you know, putting it out there so people can enjoy it.
I like that philosophy. Yeah. Sometimes we get lost in the metrics and the follows, the likes, but yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Well, Chris, we'll be sure to share your handle on the episode show notes, because you've done an amazing job with not just documenting, but also sharing the experiences that you shared with us today on the episode. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to what 2023 and 2024 has to come for you.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate it. Definitely fun to connect and share with lots of other people. So thanks for having me.
And that brings us to the end of this episode alongside Chris. We extend a heartfelt thanks to him for coming on the podcast. Make sure to stay connected and follow his upcoming adventures on Instagram at venturing_further. Be sure to check out all the episode show notes to learn more about some of the places discussed in this episode. We have an incredible lineup of episodes planned throughout the fall, and we can't wait to share them with you. New episodes will be dropping every Monday, with occasional bonus episodes on Fridays. To ensure you never miss out on those thrilling tales, remember to hit that like and subscribe button. Your support means the world to us. Don't forget to join our vibrant community on Instagram at Hikes and Mikes. We'll be sharing episode visuals, my own personal hiking content, and so much more. Let's stay connected and continue to inspire each other on this remarkable journey. As we bid farewell, remember to tread those happy trails, embrace the great outdoors, and keep the spirit of adventure alive. Until next time, my fellow explorers, happy hiking. This episode's music was created by Ketsa. Follow him on Instagram at Ketsa Music. This episode is brought to you by Flip Socks. Whether you're on the trail, on the job, or in the yard, Flip Socks will keep Mother Nature out of your boots with their innovative nylon sleeve. You no longer need to worry about any annoying debris getting trapped in your boots during your hikes. Simply flip down the nylon sleeve over any boot to prevent Mother Nature from finding its way inside, keeping your feet comfortable all day long. To get your first pair, visit flipsockswithaz.com and enter promo code HikesMikes10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for listeners who use the promo code at checkout, I'll be donating 100% of the Season 2 promo code proceeds to Big City Mountaineers, who provide transformative experiences through connections to nature that strengthen life skills and build community for youth and disinvested communities across the nation. So if you're tired of bits and pieces of the trail finding its way into your hiking boots, pick up a pair of Flip Socks today with the promo code HikesMikes10 to get 10% off. For website and promo code, see the episode description.